This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Yesterday, an Islamic website showed a videotape of an American being held hostage in Saudi Arabia. A group that identified itself as Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula allowed 49-year-old Paul Johnson to speak his name, focused the camera on his shoulder tattoo and on his Lockheed Martin identification card. A hooded man declared that Johnson would be killed unless Saudi authorities released prisoners described as Mujahideen within 72 hours by Friday. Saudi officials say they're consulting with Washington on what to do. Like its predecessors, the Bush administration declares that the United States does not negotiate with terrorists or hostage takers, but sometimes it does. What's involved in the decision to talk or not? Are some groups and some hostages different than others? Are some demands more acceptable? And what do corporations and aid organizations do with ransom demands for one of their employees? Later in the program, we'll check in on what's happened in Benton Harbor, Michigan, a year after a high-speed motorcycle chase there triggered two nights of riots. But first, negotiating with hostage takers and terrorists. In a few minutes, we'll speak with a former United Nations official who acted as a go-between in the extended negotiations to free hostages in Lebanon 15 years ago. If you have questions about how such negotiations are conducted, why governments violate declared policies, or about the aims of hostage takers, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Brian Jenkins is a terrorism specialist. He's senior advisor to the president of the RAND Corporation. Some of the reports he's co-authored include Countering Al-Qaeda and Deterrence and Influence in Countering Terrorism. He joins us now from his office in Los Angeles, California. And Brian Jenkins, good to speak with you again.
Hi, Neil.
First of all, from what you've seen of this videotape broadcast on this website yesterday, I guess, what does it say about its authenticity?
Well, it clearly indicates that there is someone who's holding this particular fellow. It's intended to confirm, in a sense, that they have this individual in captivity, that he is, at least as of the time of this video being shot, that he is alive. And it goes beyond that. It also is a way of, by mounting these threats, creating an atmosphere of terror among all who see this tape.
What do we know about this group, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula?
Well, it is probably an offshoot of the main branch of Al-Qaeda. The first use of the actual term Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, I think, began much earlier this year. It is used to describe their operations in Saudi Arabia. The bombing that took place on April 21st of this year of the Saudi security services building, they claimed credit for that attack. In fact, there was a tape issued by its reported leader, Abdulaziz Al-Mukran, on April 27th, in which he claimed credit for that particular attack, and his communique was signed Al-Qaeda, Saudi Arabian Peninsula.
We've seen Al-Qaeda take responsibility for a lot of things and be blamed for a lot of other things. Of course, spectacular bombings from New York and Washington to Bali. They have murdered people. They have captured individuals and then executed them. To what extent are they associated with taking hostages and making demands?
Well, certainly we in the training camps in Afghanistan, a lot of training material was discovered, and there were videotapes that were used for training purposes that showed kidnappings, both kidnappings of dragging people off the street and bundling them into automobiles, as well as videotapes showing training for taking over a building, as happened in Al-Khobar just recently.
Khobar, yeah.
Yeah, Khobar, where they segregated hostages, and so we know that that was part of the training regime. Now, more recently, in their online training manuals that they have been producing, there were recently, in May of this year, specific instructions for carrying out kidnappings. So this is something that is very, very much part of their continuing training doctrine.
If we hadn't seen them actually do it up till now, why this tactic? Why now?
Well, it's interesting. In Saudi Arabia, there has been a shift in tactics, unquestionably. The campaign, really this current terrorist campaign, began in May of last year with the large-scale bombings at the residential compounds in Riyadh. Those bombings, which they described as the first bullet in their campaign, nonetheless provoked a degree of criticism, in fact, within the movement itself, so much so that they came out in August of last year with a lengthy document talking about this operation, in which the intention of the document was to explain the demands of jihadi activity in the Arabian Peninsula and to remove some of the ambiguities from the religious and military standpoints. Now, the ambiguities that they were referring to were criticisms from within the movement itself about carrying out large-scale, indiscriminate bombings, which resulted in more Muslim deaths than deaths of Westerners or infidels. In fact, in that lengthy document, they claimed that the Saudi authorities had lied, that there weren't only a handful of Americans who had been killed, but rather hundreds of Americans had been killed. They also accused the Saudi authorities of lying about the number of Muslims had been killed, saying that that number had been greatly exaggerated. This obviously indicated a sensitivity. Now, they continued with this tactic for a while, but then we saw this more recent shift to precise targeting of Westerners, where they get past this problem of killing many Muslims in order to kill a few Americans.
Mm-hmm. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or give us an email totn@npr.org. And let's take a call from Ted, who's on the line with us from New York City.
Hello.
Hi.
Something comes to mind with Al-Qaeda. Either it's this big worldwide conspiracy that existed before 9/11, in which case there was a massive intelligence failure on our part, or Al-Qaeda is not as big as people assume, that many people are using their name to justify terrorist acts, and that many of them have been created after 9/11 in order to get publicity and show support for the Al-Qaeda group, which did bomb, create 9/11.
Is it an either-or situation?
No, I don't think it's either-or.
I mean,
I was actually
prior to 9/11,
Brian Jenkins, yes. Go ahead, Brian.
Clearly, prior to 9/11, there was a centralized enterprise. That is a flow of recruits, of financial support, going to the training camps in Afghanistan where people were trained, made contact with others, and then were redeployed throughout the world. And there were a number of key operational planners, men like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or Bin al-Shib or Zubaydah, who participated in planning operations worldwide. Now, the relations between this centralized enterprise and these various movements around the world varied from place to place. But Al-Qaeda always sought to graft itself upon these local movements to provide them with additional support that would raise the operational level of their activities and at the same time to be able to draw upon those local resources to carry out those attacks. So that was a continuing thing, and in some cases there were individuals in the local movements who not only had trained in the al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan, but were also part of the al-Qaeda hierarchy itself, an individual like Hambali in Southeast Asia, for example. Since September 11th, we've seen a greater decentralization of al-Qaeda. That is, there is still an al-Qaeda that is spoken for by bin Laden, by Sheikh Zawahiri, somewhere in northern Pakistan or southern Afghanistan that remains a source of inspiration that may have varying degrees of involvement in some operations, but we're now talking about many little local al-Qaedas. And that's almost precisely what we have in Saudi Arabia right now. At its core are some of the veterans of the training camps in Afghanistan. But as transactions between, let's say, the periphery, the groups locally, and the central portion of al-Qaeda have become more dangerous, that is, movement to people, movement to money, communications, these groups, as opposed to providing resources, recruits, financial support to the central enterprise, are now local operatives. So we have many al-Qaedas.
Demands for ransom of one form or another are often requests for the beginning of a dialogue, a negotiation. Given that we saw the bloody endings to the kidnappings of Daniel Pearl and Nicholas Berg by people associated now with al-Qaeda, do you see this this video that we saw yesterday as a genuine offer for some sort of contact negotiation?
Well, you know, it really is, Neil, inappropriate for me to comment or speculate publicly on the outcome or the course of action in resolving this particular episode, having been involved myself over the years in advising in negotiations and attempts to resolve these episodes. I know that even the most innocent remarks broadcast can sometimes greatly complicate the tasks of those who are attempting to bring about this individual's freedom. I think we have to be realistic. We are dealing with individuals who have no hesitation about the use of violence, no hesitation about killing individuals, and so we have to take their threat seriously. At the same time, we hope that some way, somehow, this could be resolved without safely for the hostage.
Brian Jenkins, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Brian Jenkins is a senior advisor to the RAND Corporation, and he joined us by phone from his office in Los Angeles, California. The decision to negotiate with international hostage takers involves some very weighty variables. Actually, doing it with good results is even more taxing. Johnny Pico is one of the few people who's been through this process. He's a former UN hostage negotiator. He played a central role in negotiating the release of Western hostages in Lebanon in the 1980s and 90s, including the release of American Terry Anderson and Briton Terry Waite. Mr. Pico is now chairman of an international consulting firm, GDP Associates, and he joins us from our bureau in New York City. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
What goes into the decision by a government to negotiate with hostage takers?
I think it varies considerably case by case. I think with the terrorists we have been dealing with over the last 30 years throughout the world, until very recently or until the mid-90s, was perhaps, in my view, a different kind of terrorism. To be more specific, we have been dealing for a long time in Europe, for instance, with groups, and even in the Middle East, with groups that have a very precise political and well-known objective, number one. Number two, groups that are very careful in defining who their enemy is, and even more careful in attacking whom they decide is their enemy. And usually these groups attack a very specific country or government, and is usually one, never more than one, or occasionally more than one. And that was and continues to be because there is no reason in having more enemies than one needs to have.
And we'll get to the other kind of terrorist group when we come back from a short break. Excuse me for interrupting you, Mr. Pico, but we have to take a short break now. We'll continue talking about when governments decide to talk with hostage takers and terrorists after a short break. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A bit later in today's program, in about 25 minutes, We'll be talking about the town of Benton Harbor, Michigan. A year ago today, riots erupted in Benton Harbor after a motorcyclist died at the end of a high-speed chase. We'll see how the city's doing today. If you live in Benton Harbor or nearby, you may want to join the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN at NPR.org. In the meantime, we continue our discussion on terrorists, hostage-taking, and the issue of negotiating. Do you think the government should negotiate with terrorists or hostage-takers? Our number is 800-989-8255. We're speaking today with Johnny Pico, a former United Nations hostage negotiator, among many other tasks that he performed when he was Assistant UN Secretary General under Javier Perez de Cuellar. He also wrote a book about it called Man Without a Gun, One Diplomat's Secret Struggle to Free the Hostages, Fight Terrorism, and End a War. And Johnny Pico, just before the break, you were talking about perhaps an older style of terrorist groups you were familiar with in Europe, say the IRA or ETA, the Basque separatist group, and in the Middle East in the old days, people who wanted specific goals and knew who their enemies were.
Indeed. And I should add also that we have a tradition of negotiating with these groups. Let me just remind here that the great negotiations which went on, in fact, with the IRA and indeed also with Hezbollah over the years for many reasons, including, of course, the hostages, the American hostages in Lebanon, but also other issues. This is a matter of fact which has occurred and that has been, in fact, to a large extent, been quite successful. Notice IRA and Hezbollah. Both organizations are not only very precisely rooted in their own national territory, but they also have a structure which is clearly known and definable as a military wing and a political wing. I remember even many, many years ago in the early, almost early days of Hezbollah, it was not impossible to meet one of their of their fellows who would even give you a business card saying, I come from the political office of Hezbollah, and with a telephone number and an address. I don't think you will get this from any Al-Qaeda or alleged Al-Qaeda operative. And the same thing was with the IRA. Let's not forget that when the U.S. government began to negotiate with the Northern Ireland question, Jerry Irons was considered by the British government a terrorist and so defined. And yet it was through those negotiations that today we have the situation we have in Northern Ireland. A peace agreement was reached in 1998 and all the rest. And with Hezbollah, after all, many successes were obtained because they were prepared to negotiate. And when somebody is prepared to negotiate, it means they're prepared to compromise. And when you have a compromise, you have a chance. And that is what we have been seeing so far, and dealing with these groups.
And what you see so far from Al-Qaeda suggests to you that perhaps they are not willing to negotiate?
Well, what we have seen, of course, of the classic Al-Qaeda in the years past is that when you mount an operation like against the World Trade Centers, there is no room for negotiation because there's no time for negotiations. Mm-hmm. The whole operation is not conceived to be negotiated upon. It's conceived to be executed, period. And to project the kind of pain which it has projected. So I think we have to look at the different situations every time. The decision to negotiate, unfortunately, I have to say, comes from the terrorists. It doesn't come from the other side. Hmm. The other side can only decide if they accept to engage or not.
That's a very difficult decision for many governments to accept, especially those that have this declared policy of we never negotiate.
That is correct. Let me just add to this that I believe in principle every government would take the same position. We do not negotiate with terrorists. But reality is that every government also has at heart the life of their citizens. And I would also add that every government has to take at heart the lives of the citizen, and if they can find a way to save a life, why not?
Mm-hmm. When you're involved in complex negotiations involving many different parties, and inevitably, because of the difficulties arranging meetings with all of these people, there are a lot of different parties involved. In your case, Iran, Lebanon, Syria, the U.S., and the U.N. Amongst all those groups, I mean, positions must be shifting all the time.
Yes, but let me just make a point here about exactly this different number of protagonists, so to speak, in the story of which I was a part. The CIA and MI6, British and American intelligence services, had been trying for years in Lebanon to free these people, and they did not succeed. Now, out of the blue comes this unknown individual called Gianni Pico who says, I have a plan to do it. Why? Perhaps I will try.
Mm-hmm.
And many were against it correctly. Many governments were against it correctly because they did not have the experience to do these things. But for different reasons, which had to do with what I was doing before in that region, I probably had better contact, so to speak, in that world than others. And I say this because every one of these situations is a peculiar one, and we should exploit the knowledge of those who are better situated at that particular moment. To add to all the situation, I should say that in my case, as at the time I was a UN official, the advantage was that if I had failed, governments could say, well, we never negotiated with the terrorists. This was the UN, not us. So mm-hmm. It was a perfect cover. And if I'd succeeded, so much the better. So there's nothing to lose. And this is, by the way, is a small angle to look at the UN and to see how useful it can be in moments when people usually don't think about it.
Performed a yeoman service. Again, we tend to think mostly of American hostages in Lebanon. There were hostages from, 10 or 11 different countries and, well over 100 of them before it all ended.
At some point, there were so many, yes.
How much of your work actually involved what you would describe as diplomacy in the formal sense of the word, and how much of it was exploiting these contacts that you're talking about, working in, I think you described it as the gray areas?
I don't think I ever was a diplomat. I think I was simply a common sense person which had the opportunity to see a window at some point to help another fellow human being, and just went through the window. I don't really remember being diplomatic. I remember just thinking about, look, I've given perhaps the chance to help another fellow human being. Why not doing it? And if that opportunity is given to anybody, I think anybody would take it, because I believe fundamentally that's what anybody would do.
Well, in the course of this, you were taken 9 times by kidnappers in Lebanon. No guarantee that when they took that blindfold off that you would ever come back. The last time you offered yourself as a hostage in exchange for the release of others. In part, you've attributed what you were able to do to credibility as opposed to neutrality. Explain that to us.
Yes, very, very simple. I don't think that you can be impartial when you are dealing with the situation of innocent people being kidnapped. And to be fair, even the kidnappers of these individuals, which became later, of course, my kidnappers as well,
mm-hmm.
they never asked of me that kind of impartiality. It would have been absolutely absurd. Every bone of my body and everything I'd been told until then would have indicated to me that being impartial in a case of kidnapping innocent is just impossible. In fact, you should not do it. And the fact was that that was never asked of me. They knew exactly very well where I stood. The point was I was in a position, as they told me, to surprise them, because I'd risked my life for somebody whom I never even knew. And they said, you know, this is peculiar. This is just beyond our comprehension, particularly from somebody from the West, because you in the West are terrified by death. And I had a chance and a possible replying to him, and I said, you know, look what you're talking about. I think you're more afraid than I am. And this basically was what helped a lot. And the other part, of course, I should say this, because it is a major part of the story, is that I had been dealing with the government of Iran, which was, of course, the godfather of Hezbollah, since the beginning, and I had made my diplomatic negotiation with them at a different level on what eventually they could also gain if they helped me in this endeavor. And that's for the diplomatic part. So it was on one level a negotiation with government at the real, if you like, diplomatic level, and on the other it was a different operation altogether, almost a personal operation, where individuals from different cultures and different parts of the world actually came to cross their path, and they came to cross their path in a way that eventually was somewhat, I believe, useful.
Mm-hmm. As you look back on it, I guess one of the things that you provided all of the different governments involved, and in no small part the U.S. government, plausible deniability. Again, the U.N. was doing this. They weren't doing it. In the end, did the episode and the obviously freeing the hostages was an unalloyed good thing, but in the end, did it just justify this tactic in the eyes of subsequent generations of terrorists?
I think we should bear in mind that with regard to Hezbollah, after our operation and the release of the Western hostages, There have been very, very, very few cases in the last 15 years where they've done the same thing. And the most notable, of course, was this episode of a few years ago involving the three Israeli soldiers. But there, of course, was there was a part of a military operation as well, which was conducted according to, one could say, the rule of law of war. And so it was not snatching people from the streets, innocent people are dead. It was military people involved in a military operation. So from the time we conducted an operation to this day, I don't think that we've seen a repetition in large number, or even perhaps in those specific terms, by the same actor of what we remember now with the name and the face of Terry Anderson.
Hmm. Let's get a caller involved in the conversation. And Brad is on the line. Brad's with us from Palm Coast in Florida.
Try 90.5 or 90.7.
Brad, you're on the radio.
Yeah, thank you. I think there's times where you do need to go to negotiate. You can't just take a hard line all the time. In the most recent situation, this guy is over there. He's not in the military. He didn't buy into the risk. He's over there trying to improve upon a situation that we actually created, right, wrong, or otherwise, and try to improve his life over there financially and otherwise. And there's times where we just have to sort of take responsibility for that and be flexible.
And I guess, Brad, I guess the one answer to that, and we'll obviously our guest, Johnny Pico, has much more understanding of this than I do, but what do you tell the next guy's family when the people who kidnapped this guy kidnap him and ask for more demands?
Well, I wonder if we tell these folks that go over there to the mechanics and the plumbers, et cetera, I wonder if we tell them that, look, you have a risk of dying over there just by performing your trade as a result of situations that our country created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Johnny Pico, obviously there are situations where governments decide they do need to negotiate.
Yes, indeed. And I think that it has a lot to do, again, with the group that performs this kind of activity. First and foremost, I think a government will have to decide and to understand, to the extent possible, who is actually behind this kind of activity. And only then a decision can be made on how to proceed, how to move forward, whether it is in one way or another. But I think that is a first step. Who are these people? And as I say, if these people have a specific objective is one thing. If they have multiple or vague objective or general objectives, a different matter. And as I say, it also depends how they are structured. And all this consideration, I'm sure, are now in the mind of many in Washington. But as I say, it's not just the act of kidnapping. It depends who does it. And who they are.
Johnny Pico, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Johnny Pico was a United Nations hostage negotiator, amongst many other things. He wrote about his experiences in the book Man Without a Gun, One Diplomat's Secret Struggle to Free the Hostages, Fight Terrorism, and End a War. And he joined us from our bureau in New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We now turn to a story developing out of the Netherlands. 2 weeks ago, the Dutch government admitted it paid a ransom to secure the release of Adam Erkel, the former head of operations for Doctors Without Borders in southern Russia. Dr. Erkel had been held hostage for close to 2 years. He was set free last month. Now the Dutch government wants Doctors Without Borders to pay them back the $1.2 million it took to secure his freedom. The dispute has publicized the fact that ransom was paid. Critics are concerned the news may encourage more kidnappings. Joining us now from his home in Amsterdam is Rob Vreeken. He's a reporter on the foreign desk of De Volkskrant International Newspaper, and thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, hello.
The Dutch government maintains they only paid this ransom because Doctors Without Borders promised to pay it back. The charity says we never promised to pay the money back. Is this really disagreement about money, or is something else involved here?
Well, there is a disagreement about the money. The government says they just lent the money and that the Doctors Without Borders promised to pay it back, which they deny. But, of course, there's a background of many months of irritation, quarrels, and disagreement about the whole approach of the affair. Doctors Without Borders has always been very critical of the Dutch government and says that the government has not done enough, has been more in interested in good relations with the Russian government and has failed to put pressure on the Russians to act. And so that is what they have been saying all the time. At a certain moment, they even went public with a public campaign, advertisements, etc.
Which must not have pleased the government.
Which did not please the government at all. So they even broke off contact between them in March or April this year.
But at the end of the day, we do know that money was paid. So who did the negotiations? Was it the Dutch government? Was it Doctors Without Borders?
It's very unclear. I think in the final stage, the Dutch government did the negotiations. Before that, Doctors Without Borders has done negotiations. And what is known is that there was an intermediate group of Russian veterans who actually did the real negotiations with the guys who did the kidnapping, former security people of the Russian government.
They were the ones who did the kidnapping.
They
were the ones who did the negotiating. Yes.
And who made a deal. So there was never been any direct contact with the government and the kidnappers.
So that gives a plausible deniability to the Dutch government statements that they did not pay ransom.
Yes, well, they gave money. They acknowledged that, but they said we just gave it because at that moment Doctors Without Borders hadn't had the money in cash, so we just paid it for them.
Loaned them their money so they could make the payment.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how is this news being received in the Netherlands? Are people taking sides?
I don't know if they're taking sides, but it doesn't give a very good impression of the government, but certainly not for the Doctors Without Borders, because they also, within their own organization, there's a bit of a mess about who is speaking on behalf of the organization. There have been some fights and disagreements within the organization. Actually, the guy who has been kidnapped, Mr. Urkel, has taken sides with the government against his own employer.
It gets complicated. Is this going to end up in court?
It will end up in court. The government has announced they will go to court, yes.
So I guess we'll find out in testimony a lot more about who authorized who to pay what to whom and how all of this was handled.
Maybe some truth will come out of the courtroom. Of course, the Dutch government doesn't want to be on record as a country that is willing to pay ransom. So that's why they are so firm on this. It's not a matter of money, it's a matter of principle.
Thank you, Rob Vreeken.
Okay.
Rob Vreeken is a reporter on the foreign desk of De Volkskrant International Newspaper, and he joined us on the phone from Amsterdam. When we come back, he was talking about why the government did not want to be known as a payer of ransoms. What do corporations do when their employees are taken hostage? We'll discuss that after we come back from a break and go back a year later to Benton Harbor, Michigan. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Here are some of the headlines today from NPR News. The commission investigating the U.S. response to the 9/11 attacks says it found no credible evidence that Saddam Hussein had ties with al-Qaeda. That contradicts earlier Bush administration claims. The commission is holding its final hearings this week here in Washington. And the United Nations is appealing for more money to help refugees in western Sudan. The Darfur region is the scene of what many are calling an ethnic cleansing campaign by government-backed Arab militias. More on those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. A bit later in today's program on Talk of the Nation, we'll discuss the town of Benton Harbor, Michigan. A year ago today, riots erupted there after a motorcyclist died at the end of a high-speed police chase. We'll see how the city's doing today. If you live in Benton Harbor or nearby, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. In the meantime, we continue our discussion on terrorism, hostage-taking, and the issue of negotiations. This is a concern not just for governments, but for companies as well sometimes. Joining us now from his office in Fairfax, Virginia, is Sean McQueenie. He's president of Corporate Risk International, a U.S.-based company that specializes in security services. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
I understand your company works with other companies whose employees have been kidnapped. Describe the relationship, if you will.
Well, we represent groups of companies here in the United States and elsewhere throughout the world, and some wealthy families and individuals, where we respond on their behalf if one of their members is the victim of a kidnapping or an extortion anywhere in the world.
So you go negotiate for them.
We do the negotiations. We liaise with the local police forces, various countries in the world. We deliver the ransom, which sometimes is the most dangerous thing we do, and end up doing pretty much everything, depending on the level of law enforcement support in the countries. The United States, for example, the FBI generally does most of the negotiations and a lot of the investigation and so forth, but we maintain relationships to find out what's going on and so forth.
On behalf of the companies in other countries, obviously you may be the most prominent.
In certain countries, for example, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Mexico, we end up sometimes doing everything.
When you are negotiating circumstances in those countries, is the U.S. government involved if it's a U.S. company that you're working for?
If it's an American victim and the country has no objection, and for example, in Colombia, Ecuador, we've worked side by side with the FBI agents that were flown in from the United States. These are expert negotiators, and they have assisted us as we represent the family members and the company in the negotiation process.
To some degree, as you certainly know better than I, these kidnappings are political. To some degree, they are mercenary. Is there any concern that by paying ransoms, dealing with kidnappers, you're just encouraging more?
There's no question. That's always one of the issues. Colombia, it's a huge issue, but it just it's kind of a reality what's happening. You're seeing a lot of that now in the Middle East and elsewhere in South Asia. The Al-Qaeda-type groups are going to be doing these kidnappings and eventually asking for ransoms and so forth, and governments are going to have to address it like Colombia has addressed it. When we did a kidnap response in Colombia, they have an anti-kidnapping division, which we have to liaise with and let them know what we're doing. But they had so many incidents, and if they trust you and they trusted us, our company, they would allow us to proceed with the negotiations as long as we let them know generally what we were doing. And other countries are going to have to do basically the same thing because families, members are going to demand that something be done to try and rescue their family member who falls victim to this kind of a crime.
Sean McQueenie, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Sean McQueenie, president of Corporate Risk International, a security services firm. He joined us from his office in Fairfax, Virginia. Let's get another call in on this subject. Henry joins us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hey, how are you?
Thanks. Very well, thanks. Okay.
I worked in the region. I worked for a company where we cleared landmines.
In the Middle East is what you mean?
Yes, sir. And I worked for a couple of years there. And, you know, we would get constant updates of how dangerous the area was. And that's really what dictated our salary. The more dangerous it was, the more money you made.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, when they gave us the opportunity to leave the area because it became too dangerous, you put a price on your own head. You know that it's a very unstable area, and I feel like, well, that's why I'm not there now. I could be making a lot of money out of there, but I value my life too much. And these people have an agenda. You know, the various factions out there have their agenda, and you get caught up in it. Just like these, you know, there's no reason why the Iraqis can't drive their own trucks. We should be putting the Iraqis to work in their own country, and I think that would help stabilize the country.
But I know you can see yourself in Mr. Johnson's shoes a little bit, I'm sure. What would you want the government to do?
I would want the government to do what's best for the United States and for the country. I was in the military for 20 years. I understand the importance of the mission overall. And I think that people that go over there, bottom line, people that go over there for money. You put a price on your own head. But we should be putting Iraqis to work instead of people making $120,000 a year driving a truck.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, Henry.
You're welcome.
And we'll leave with this email from Jane Taylor in Baltimore. I know it's emotional and we want to save our citizens, but I do not agree with negotiating for terrorists of any stripe. Freeing terrorist prisoners, she wrote, will most likely cause more than the death of one or two hostages. And we'll continue to cover the story on NPR News as developments warrant.